Hi, Bob.
Hey, Carl, how are you?
I'm doing fine. I'm speaking with Bob Batchelor, the author of several biographical subjects, including Stan Lee and John Updike. But let's get started by just telling us a little bit about yourself and how you got into the biography business.
I was thinking about this, Carl, and it really starts back as early as I can remember. I was always a individual person. I think, baseball cards, I liked players more than I liked teams. And as I started to read and learn in the school system, I was more interested in the exploits of individual leaders than kind of the larger picture. Now, that changed a bit, but it really made me enjoy biography. I remember as a kid reading, Scholastic used to put out these cheap books of biographies of like three leading sports figures. And I devoured those because we didn't have books in my house, and those were really cheap, and I could scrounge up a little bit of money for those. So I've always been attracted to biography and always wanted to write biography, even though as I advanced in the education system, they tried to beat that out of me.
We could talk about that. So, what you say about the playing cards, I just never thought about that. I was obsessed with baseball playing cards when I was a kid. And I remember going over to a friend of mine who had an older brother. Now, this would have been in the mid 1950s when I was just, maybe 8, 9, 10 years old. And this older brother was maybe 10 years older. And he pulled out these baseball cards, from the late 1940s. And, it was like the Dead Sea Scrolls. I just was absolutely taken with this. And then, as in your case, I remember checking out biographies from the library. And I remember, a biography of Lou Gehrig that was so moving. I had never seen Lou Gehrig play, but the biography sort of, brought him to life. It was such a phenomenal experience. And a biography of Thomas Edison, in some cases like Thomas Edison and Henry Ford. I was growing up in Detroit, and Edison had been sort of a kid on train selling stuff before he became an inventor, and all that kind of stuff I really identified with.
Yeah, Carl, your work on biography and particularly the theoretical work you've done and the history of biography you've done has had such a tremendous impact on my thinking that I find myself having conversations with you through your books. And I start to think, well, what really did happen to me? Because there is a distinct inbred love for biography. For me, it was certainly the baseball cards. And also, there were two. I remember reading a biography of Fran Tarkington, which most people listening to us are not even going to remember. He was one of the greatest quarterbacks of all time for the Minnesota Vikings.
The
And
shotgun.
yeah, and then reading a dual biography. I think maybe in seventh grade, I read Fran Brody's psychobiography of Thomas Jefferson, and it just changed everything for me. I mean, I wanted to do this, but then, I could continue my fascination through high school, but even as early as an undergrad, in my history major, my professors, I did a senior thesis, and they wouldn't let me do a straightforward biography, and that just continued, and I kept fighting back against that and worming against it and finding advisors who might just let me pursue this a little bit. And that was kind of the beginning. I became more interested in just writing books, and I would just slam as much biography in the books as I possibly could and get away with whatever the topic was supposed to be.
Yeah, that's the in my case, here you have this, as a child, this fascination with biography, and just taking it as natural. Why not reading these books? not really thinking all the way through graduate school. I never said, oh, I'm going to grow up to be a biographer. No one in graduate school ever presented biography as a kind of worthy, certainly scholarly enterprise. And it wasn't until I was got very interested in certain popular culture figures, including Marilyn Monroe, and I started reading biographies of her and realized there was something missing from those books that I thought, because of my background in acting, that I was prepared to understand about her career. And it was only then, when I wrote my first biography, which was of Marilyn Monroe, I got this wonderful letter from my dissertation supervisor, who actually had written one biography, a scholarly biography of Thomas Hardy, but had not encouraged me to write biography. And the thing he said after he read my Marilyn Monroe biography, he was quite complimentary. But one of the things that he said is, you sure didn't learn any of that in graduate school. That is, how to write that, how to do a biography. Most biographers are self-taught.
Yeah, I will say, two things to that point. The first being that understanding your past as an actor that led you to Marilyn Monroe was almost the same path that I took in my love affair with John Updike, and then the eventual biography that I wrote of him, because when I read John Updike, we grew up, if you drew a straight line 300 miles across the state of Pennsylvania, he grew up on the east part of that line. I grew up on the west part. When I read John Updike, I sense Pennsylvania, and I sense a common ideology, a common zeitgeist. It's as if Pennsylvania is a very unique state, and I can sense and smell and feel Pennsylvania in his writing. It's one of the things that drew me. And so I do like your vision of being an actor and understanding how you can add to that. One of the chapters of my Updike biography is, Updike as Pennsylvanian, and I talk about my experiences reading him, and then, how Pennsylvania shaped him as an author, because it remained a main part of his catalog for the rest of his life. I mean, on his deathbed, he's writing poems about his youth in Pennsylvania. So a very much, in touch with the way that you see your evolution, and on a somewhat similar path. So it's very much there and part of the thinking. I will say also that I got my dissertation late in life. I had already written, I think, 8 books by the time I went into grad school, and it placed me in a really strange setting. I was at the University of South Florida. By day, I was teaching, and so I was going to cocktail parties and saying, "Hey, Joe," or whatever. And then at night, I'm taking classes, and then all of a sudden, it's Dr. So and so. But I had a dissertation advisor and a mentor, and he's still my mentor. He's a film scholar, and also Hemingway and Fitzgerald, a brilliant man named Philip Scipiora. And he not only allowed me to kind of push my biography much, or my dissertation much further toward biography, but he has remained a steadfast mentor as I've left academe, left scholarly writing, and moved, wholly into trade. I just got a email from him yesterday, and he's just the most wonderful mentor. Whereas other friends I know who made a move out of the scholarly world into trade or into other areas, they're not so lucky. Let's just put it
Yeah,
that way.
I understand that. So, Updike was your first biography.
I don't know. With so many. Maybe I wrote a short biography of Bob Dylan. I'd have to look, Carl, to tell you the truth. I don't even know the first, because the first book I wrote was a okay. So it's crazy. The first book I wrote was a biography of a decade, the decade from 1900 to 1910. So I'm writing this book, and the eminent pop culture scholar of American history is this guy named Ray Brown, who was at Bowling Green.
Yeah.
Thankfully, you know, he was a great guy, and he gave me this book deal long before I deserved it. But he did, and so he was doing this whole series. Every decade of American history was getting its own book, and I got 1900 to 1910 because I had a little bit of a reputation for that era. And so I filled that book with idea. You know, it's basically a book filled with biographies broken down by, you know, there's like a chapter on literature, a chapter on sports and entertainment, things like that. So all the books have been. And then later, I wrote a biography of The Great Gatsby. So I wrote a biography of a novel. I wrote a biography of Dylan. The Mad Men book that I co-authored with Keith Booker, that's basically a biography of a TV show. Then I actually wrote things that would actually be 100% in the biography category, like the Stan Lee biography and The Bourbon King, which is George Remus's biography. So everything I've been trying and playing around with this idea of biography my whole life, and just trying to fit it in wherever I can. And now I'm trying to go beyond just writing books and seeing where I can push into other creative areas and still focus on biography.
Yeah, it reminds me of Nigel Hamilton's book, his History of Biography, in which he says biography is more than books. And I think, you know, it's there in all kinds of media. It's obviously there in documentary film, for example.
Definitely. I've even started the Scripps local ABC television station here in Cincinnati has a morning lifestyle show. And they asked me to do a true crime segment. So bi-monthly, every other week, I go on, I do the research on some true crime in the tri-state because, you know, Cincinnati, we're right here at the intersection of Kentucky, Ohio, and Indiana. So I pick some interesting true crime story, write the script, the host reads the script, and then they show pictures and I come on and then talk about other facets of it. It's like a little mini documentary, but in my mind, these are just little bios. I'm just doing a little bio and using true crime as the hook to tell this interesting little story of a gangster or a would-be assassin or whatever has happened. You know, this week coming up on Tuesday, the first train robbery in American history happened just outside of Cincinnati. That's less biography because they're not really sure who did it. They never found out who did it. But some of the other stories are much more person-based. And so I'm trying to find ways. You know, when I talk to our friend Billy Tuma, who is a biographer and documentarian, you know, the one thing I wish that I would have done if I could go back in time is study film editing and filmmaking, because I think that's where I would be. I just don't have the skills. And I don't know if I have enough time left to learn the skills, in
my
career.
It's funny you should say that because until this goes back to around the year 2000, which is when I got interested in doing a biography of Joe Craigie, who was a documentary filmmaker, among other things. And I had never paid that much attention to documentaries. And I had never taught a documentary film course, although with the interest in Marilyn Monroe and Hollywood, I was certainly, you know, very interested in film. And I suddenly looked around where I was teaching at Baruch College, part of the City University of New York, and I saw that there was this documentary film course that nobody really, occasionally somebody taught it. And I thought, boy, I'm gonna make that my course. And I suddenly, you know, it suddenly occurred to me how important it is, an understanding of documentary film and how documentaries are shot and put together, which has, you know, incredible relevance to biography. That's for sure. Say a little bit about how you work. Do you just read, 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 research, 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 and then write, or you do a little of one and then a little of the other?
The actual process has evolved, over time. But I think what I did early is that I learned, and I coach people on writing, and I've been doing this. I've worked in every part of publishing, including acquiring books, writing catalog copy, but also coaching authors. So, and then teaching writing, as you know, you learn a lot when you're teaching writing. And that's what I spent, 16 years doing. So I learned my process and what works for me. And I just apply that every time that I set out to write something. So I never have to worry. Writer's block doesn't exist for me. It's because I know my process so well.
Yeah,
But I'm
that's a good
also,
point. Yeah.
yeah, I mean, it's if you learn your process, and even though I'm not much of a mathematician, I break books down into very small, finite pieces and figure, well, I can't write a chapter today. I don't have 8,000 words in me, but I might have a section of a chapter that's 500 words. And I can write 500 words about any topic. So, I don't fear that. And so when I start, like if I sign a book deal today, I'm going to start writing that day and researching. I already know some bit of what I'm going to write about. For me, I got to get the table of contents into some working order. And from there, it pretty much spills out. And then I'm just constantly researching and writing at the same time because I'd rather get some writing down and have that in some way through osmosis or just subconscious starts to develop the ideas. It's like I'm having a conversation with myself while I'm having a conversation with the sources. And that seems to work for me. I know some people like to do all the research and I can't work like that. I need to be engaging in the creativity while I'm engaging in the research and the learning of the
I
topic.
work almost exactly the same way. And in fact, I belong to not that many, but a few writers' groups, biographers' groups. And almost invariably, people will talk about what an agony it is to write, or they're stuck, or there's writer's block. And what you say about knowing your process, and it must be something about our temperaments too, because I've just never suffered from writer's block. And when I say these things to people, I think, you know, they look at me like, you know, is this guy lying, or is he superficial? And, you know, if he's not, if you're not agonizing, you're not serious. I'm not sure what it is, but once somebody asked me, this was in a group, and this was very spontaneous. Someone said, "Well, how do you organize your work?" And I said, "I don't have time to organize." And it was funny, but it's sort of true. That is, when I write, that's when I organize things, and that's why I can't wait to write until I've researched everything. You know, Ronald Heyman, very good biographer, once said he wrote a whole first draft without doing any research. And at the time when he said, I said, "I, God, I couldn't do that." And I haven't ever really done a book that way, but I sort of understand what he means, because I don't really know what I want to say or how I'm going to organize it until, you know, a sentence appears on the paper.
Yeah, that's very interesting. I what I think most readers don't understand, and even some maybe some writers who aren't writing books, they're just doing articles or whatever. You have a limit. I mean, even for your masterful two-volume work of Faulkner, you probably could have written 100,000 more words. But even in a two-volume, I mean, so no matter what it is, there is a limitation. And my publishers have always been, within plus or minus 10%. So I know how many words it's going to be. And then I break down the chapters. So then I know, well, if you divide 12 chapters by 90,000 words, that gives you a number. And if they're going to be 4 points per chapter, that gives you another number. And I can write those. And that's all the process that I need. I don't know necessarily if I just have a general idea of what I'm going to do. For the Remus book, Bourbon King, I did it chronologically. For Stan Lee, I did it basically chronologically. But the Bob Dylan biography that I wrote, I did thematically, because I thought it was the only interesting way, because so many people have spent their entire lives digging through Bob Dylan's garbage that I'm not going to do a day-by-day biography of Bob Dylan that's going to do anything more than anybody else has done. So, but for me, it's just all about the words. And I don't usually talk about process that much unless I'm teaching somebody, because I don't want them to think like, oh, this guy thinks he's something special. I was like, no, I don't have a lot of talents. You know, I used to be a pretty good basketball player. I can make a mean martini. But writing in research, that's it. That's my skill set. So I apply it, and the words come out, and the books come out, and everything's fine.
It almost sounds, when I say it's sort of cold or commercial, you know, a biography is a book. It is a product. And if you look at it that way, that doesn't mean you're not inspired, or you don't admire your subject, or you don't have passion about it, but it is something that you're putting together. And that's certainly what I sense in what you say. Now, you no longer have an academic position. So how are you making a living?
Nope. That's a great...
See, I never wanted to face that. I've always been teaching. I always had this salary to count on.
So I have had a very strange career, because I wanted to be an academic. And then when I was going to grad school, I was meeting, you know, historians from Harvard who were driving taxis in New York City because they couldn't get an academic job. You know, we're talking about the early to mid 90s. And so I found a job doing this thing that's called heritage management. And it's essentially using a company's history to promote its current endeavors or to build employee morale, things like that. So a company that would go to Ford and create a historical display for their 20,000-foot auditorium in their headquarters, or organize their archives, things like that, or do interviews with retiring executives. That led to me leaving grad school and going into this kind of specialized public relations and marketing. And then I did that for the next 10 years and really had a highly successful career as a communicator. My last full-time corporate job, I was a VP in corporate marketing at Bank of America, which was at then the ninth largest company in the world. By the time I think I was 30. So I was really having a lot of success. But then I got tired of that because I was working long hours. So I figured maybe I could get a job either teaching or running communications for a university. And it just so happened that I got a full-time teaching job, teaching communications and writing to communication students at the University of South Florida. So I had more than a decade of corporate experience, then started teaching in a school of mass communication. So the things were dovetailing, and got the PhD at USF because they're like, you know, you got to get the union card if you want to stay in this. So, you know, I was able to buzz through that because it didn't take me, you know, I'd already written 8 books, I think, by that time. So that was no problem. It, you know, taking the classes was a pain, but getting the PhD was pretty easy. I did that in 4 years, then bumped around to a couple different universities. My problem was that I accepted, at 42, I was offered an endowed chair. And for family reasons, I stayed in that endowed chair for 2 or 3 years and had to leave it. And you know how academe is. If you leave an endowed chair, you have a black mark on you because everybody just thinks you're a foul ball at that point. Why would you, and why would anybody, when this is the height, this is the Hall of Fame move and you leave it, there must be something wrong with you. So at the same time, I'm getting less interested in academe. So because I wanted readers, I had done enough scholarly stuff. I wanted readers and I want listeners and I want viewers. And that's why I keep moving more into mainstream engagement. So I left teaching. My last gig was at Miami University teaching strategic communications. And that was during the pandemic. So what I'm doing now is going back to that original love that I have for heritage management. So I've been freelancing as a high-level strategic communications counselor consultant for a very prominent company in that space. There aren't very many of them. I can't really talk about the work that I'm doing. There are lots of non-disclosures and things, but for example, 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, maybe, I did a history-based presentation for a NBA team so that its sales season sales ticket staff would understand more about the team's history. And a project before that, two software companies were forming into a $22 billion conglomerate. And they wanted a digital history museum. And so I research, wrote, helped design that site. And I find this work incredibly satisfying. It's financially lucrative enough that I can do it. I don't have to do it full time, though maybe at some point I will go into that full time. But I could never, I can never make a living just writing, but my public relations and marketing background, I could definitely do that. I could make more writing a speech for a CEO than I made on, the Bourbon King. Much more. I mean, twice, tw two or three times as much
No, I think
because.
that's true for almost all of us, except for the really, really big prize-winning popular biographers.
But I can still find creative ways. And so I think as I get older and like I've said, I'm 10 books. I think I've edited 20 books. So I mean, we're talking, I'm 30, th over 30 books into this career. Now I'm looking for ways to find readers, find larger audiences and engage with people because the only thing I don't like about it is I think I know you well enough to know maybe you share this. I don't like the publishing industry that much. I think it's a very dirty game and it's just tough. I don't like to be told what to write or what I can and can't write. But if you want to do books, you gotta it's just a weird. I mean, people outside it, they don't understand. It's impossible to understand. It's,
The most, yeah.
I have a book proposal out now that I know would be a fantastic book, and I know people would love to read, but the entire publishing industry is trying to make up for 200 years of not publishing people of color all in one fell swoop. So I'm hearing from friends who are in the same boat, they can't get book deals because if it's not in a certain category, it's not going to get, it's not going to get
It's always
seen.
been true in publishing that the most popular word that they have is no.
So I think I wish that 10 years ago I would have went with my gut, because 10 years ago, when self-publishing and independent publishing and the Kindle was being developed and all that, I sat down and I had been working in technology long enough that I knew this was going to work. But I was still, immersed in academe, and I needed that reputational piece. So I kind of poo-pooed that. But if I back then, you it was, it's much easier to start back when it was the Wild West days. It's very difficult to get into indie publishing now because too many people have commercialized it enough. It's hard to get people to listen. And but I don't want this to turn into a sad sack thing, because I'm a very lucky person. I have written the books that I wanted to write. I have, some interesting projects that I can't quite announce, but I just launched a podcast, which is a labor of love, that's going to be focused on John Updike. I'm doing this TV gig. I have some things in LA that are kind of percolating through the system. So I'm a very happy biographer. I just don't like the gatekeeping and the status-based aspects of publishing.
So
So,
what Bob Batchelor book should readers begin with?
people really, universally, readers have loved both the Stan Lee biography and The Bourbon King. And I wrote them both for people who you don't have to be a Marvel fan to like the Stan Lee biography, because I describe myself as a cultural historian, and it hurt me in academe, but it's great now because, like, my master's degree is in history, but my PhD is in English lit, and so I bring all these things together. I don't just look at the literary aspects or the history, or I try to pull all this stuff in. So reading Stan Lee, you're going to learn as much about, the business of publishing magazines. You're going to learn about the history of New York City. If you read The Bourbon King, I tell people Cincinnati and Kentucky are co-stars in this
Yeah, they
book.
are.
Yeah, you're going to learn the history of distilling and how distilleries operate. You're going to learn a lot about American history through the lens of this very interesting character. So I think that's kind of my niche in the game, is that, somebody once told me historians don't do culture that well. Literary people don't know history. And if you know the way that they're trained in grad school, that's certainly true for a lot of academics. Those of us in, like, you and like our fellow bio members that do this stuff well, we've somehow pushed through that and are able to pull those different pieces together.
Yes, I went to as an undergraduate, I went to Michigan State University, and both the history department and the English department were in Morrill Hall. One was on one floor and one was on the other. And I was sort of a double major in English and history and was equally interested in both subjects. And I got to know some of the professors, and I would sometimes say to an English professor, Professor so and so in history, often they didn't even know the name, a historian on just the floor above them. They had no, they were completely cocooned in their discipline in their departments.
And one of the things I think, it's a mistake that I made. I made the mistake of calling myself a popular culture scholar, because I wanted to be the next Ray Brown, and that's where I was headed. I mean, that's what people are like, yeah, you're his successor. You are headed toward that. But you go to an English department, the typical snooty English department, you call yourself a pop culture scholar, you might as well put a red X on your chest. But if you call yourself a film noir scholar, it's okay. But if you look at it, it's the same thing. So if I would have called myself a Stuart Hall theorist, I would have been doing the same thing, but labeled differently.
Right. Yeah, when I
and with more authority.
Yeah, when I first latched on to biography and was doing my Marilyn Monroe biography, if you looked in the early 1980s, if you saw anything relating to Marilyn Monroe, it would be about one of her directors, like John Huston. The idea of doing a biography of an actress, any actress, let alone Marilyn Monroe,
exactly.
It just wasn't done. You just didn't do it. And when I looked at Ray Brown, what did Ray Brown do at Bowling Green State University? He essentially created his own empire. You know, I mean, that's the way he did it. He established his own press. In other words, he didn't play somebody else's game. He invented a new game.
Yeah, and you know, the thing is, I that's essentially what I've been trying to model in my career. But then, you know, I got too tired of it. I mean, like I said, leaving that endowed chair was the final straw. And it just took a couple more years for me to realize, like, I knew I had some people who shouldn't have done this, because you know how academic search committees work. But I had some people say, hey, look, this is the problem. And it happened a couple times. And so, but I was already so far removed from it intellectually. Yeah. You know, I'd much rather find a different way and be happy. And this life that I lead now, I'm very happy. I don't have the security. I never used to think that I was entrepreneurial. And then I started to tell people, I've really been planning this move for a couple of years. And I would kind of sneakily tell people, hey, I'm getting out of this academe business. I just can't take it anymore. And I said, but I'm a little nervous. I'm not very entrepreneurial. And they look at me and say, Bob, you're the most entrepreneurial person that I know, but I just couldn't. I couldn't see myself as it, because I grew up really, really poor, and so stability, financial stability, to me, had a deep rooted kind of piece of. But now, you know, it's a little bit different, and you know, I got remarried, and my wife Suzette is a marketing executive, and she is completely supportive. And we together work on brand Bob Batchelor every day. I mean, it's every single day. I am the family brand, and we work toward building that brand.
That's terrific. Yeah, that's really good. Yeah, what you say about your experience, I've certainly had similar experiences. I remember when I was a young assistant professor at Wayne State University, an older colleague of mine got tenure. And I said, well, Ted, how does it feel to get tenure? And he said, the only thing worse than not getting tenure at Wayne State University is getting tenure at Wayne State University. He was already feeling a sense of doom, like he was trapped. You know, I can't ever give this up. And you have just explained to us why.
Yeah. And I mean, people... When I moved away from academe, I mean, I did it wholeheartedly, and I lost some friends, but getting out from under that negativity and that awful umbrella, I mean, the jealousy in academe I mean, you know, a disagreement in a faculty meeting, and it's daggers for the next 20 years. Because, you know, because people have tenure. And look, I'm a very proud Gen Xer, and Gen X has been decimated in academe. I don't have very many friends my age who are full professors. And, you know, so, you know, what are you going to do? I mean, I made some choices. Nobody put a gun to my head, but the best choice I made was to get out. Because now I have so much, I have so many, I wish I could tell you all the things that I have going on. Now, I'm not going to become a millionaire from any of these things, but I think I'm going to piece together a life just as financially consequential. And that's good enough. But I'm going to be doing the creative projects that I love, and that's the most important thing right
Well,
now
I
for
hope
me.
this will inspire some other people to think, in different ways about how to support themselves and write biography. I want to come back full circle. I can't, Bob, I can't get over once you mentioned baseball cards. I want to say a little bit more about how this occurred because I think it does speak to the nature of biography. So I have this friend, he's my age. We go over, his older brother has these cards, but I didn't tell the whole story. The whole story is we're sitting around playing with, I'm the Detroit Tigers, Al Kaline generation. For people who are baseball fans, they know what I'm talking about. It doesn't matter if they do or not. And then this older brother, comes, and he comes with this paper bag, which I didn't know then was full of baseball cards. And he dumps the bag out in front of us, and then that's when I get, these baseball cards with Warren Spahn. Again, probably, you have to be my age to know who that Warren Spahn was, a pitcher, and so on. And it just suddenly occurred to me, what was that about? I've just had this flash. It's just like when I walked into the Beinecke Library at Yale University when I was doing my Rebecca West biography. They had a huge collection of hers, which they had never cataloged because it was restricted. So they figured, well, why should we bother? And she had died, and her son had just died, opening up the Yale archive. And they took them 3 hours to find the boxes. So then they bring out a box, this big black box. And I open it up, and I'm not kidding, because it wasn't cataloged, and it wasn't in folders. It was just material she sent them that they just stuffed into boxes. So here comes the box, out spills all this stuff, and it's about the Nuremberg trials. And then all of a sudden, what's in there? Her love letters to a Nuremberg prosecutor. I mean, it was just Francis Biddle. It was just unbelievable. And I think it really, it spoke to that early childhood sense of wonder and discovery that somebody has treasures to show.
Yeah, I would agree. The third wheel of the love triangle between George Remus, Imogene Remus, is this G-man. He's the top undercover G-man in the
Oh, he's
Prohibition
such a
Bureau named
fascinating
Franklin
character in the
Dodge.
book. He's just marvelous.
He's like the he's and I know you would love him because he's like a film star of that era. He's got the movie star good looks and he's big guy. He carries two guns. He's the top undercover guy. I mean, this guy himself is a movie waiting to happen. Well, Suzette and I, we find out that he's from a very wealthy family in Lansing. The two families that came together to found Lansing, Michigan are his parents, his dad and his mom's side of the family. So his home is a one, it's a the house museum. They rent it out for weddings and stuff now. So Suzette and I go up there with our oldest daughter, and we spend the day there. And I'm walking around, and his bedroom is just like it was when he was a teenager. And Suzette, what she's great at is sweet talking the archivist or whoever runs the place into getting that secret file. You know, the secret file they never really want to show you? Well, Suzette is a master at so very gently saying, "So, what is it that other people don't get to see?" And so then from there, I get pictures that other people don't get, and I get them in the book, and I get information, and I get the folklore just because it's and so that sense of wonder, I love that in archival research. For me, the baseball cards got to be such an obsession. I can't remember the game what it was called, but there was some baseball game. It's like Strat-O-Matic, I think. You had these cards, so it was like Babe Ruth. You spun this little spinner, and they calculated like the number of times he hit a single versus strikeout versus, and so whatever you spun it would spin around and land on that, and then they had pegs, and you worked around the board. So from that, I became obsessed with not only baseball cards, but statistics. And it became even more of a game to me. So I would use like modern players. Barry Bonds is Willie McCovey is like Babe Ruth. And I would substitute him in all this crazy stuff. But it became a giant game. So for me, the game aspect of finding stuff and writing biography and writing books, and then now the game aspect of how can I market and brand myself and get into places, it's really a game kind of mentality that's formed. And I can take that directly back to when I was like 7 or 8 years old, and certainly by 12 or 14. I mean, I'm completely immersed in it. And it's funny, those tendrils still wrap through to today.
Yeah.
And, still right there in my mind.
We could go on forever. We're going to have to do this again, Bob. I'm going to call a halt now.
Yeah.
Just because you've already said a number of things, including about Suzette, which reminds me of some things that my wife and I have done together, where we've gotten things that otherwise wouldn't have been obtainable. But I want to thank you. This has just been really a pleasure and I think really illuminating.
Well, thank you, Carl. I have immensely enjoyed your podcast, as I've told you, and I wish more people would follow your lead, because I know that there are a lot of things that people could learn. And I don't know if you know this, so stop me if you do, but two nights ago, we were watching this Zoom special on the new Hemingway series that Ken Burns and Lynn Novick did. You know, it's getting ready to come out in April. Well, they had some guest speakers, and one of the woman guest speaker on there, I can't remember her name, but she wrote the biography of the Murphys.
Oh yeah, Amanda Vale.
Amanda Vale. Yeah, she name dropped you in this special.
No, I didn't know that.
So talking to Ken Burns and Lynn Novick and the moderator and another and some writer they had on there. She mentioned you. Right. So if you can ever get your hands on this, she was talking about your thoughts about authorized versus unauthorized. Oh, yeah. Because of course Ken Burns gets the authorization of the Hemingway estate, whereas you or I would be denied in like two seconds. And but of course Ken Burns gets it, and she makes this point. But she used you as a jumping off point. So if you can find a copy of that, I think, you know, it's on PBS. You got name dropped on a pretty big time national TV.
Appearance. Well, that's great. And all I can say is, Ken, I'm available.
Exactly. That's what I was thinking. I'm like, if Carl knew this, I mean, so it's, I think, Carl, that speaks to what you've been able to do for biography, and not only as a writer yourself, but as the premier scholar of biography, I think, in the whole world. So thank you. And thanks for this conversation.
Okay, thanks a lot, Bob. Talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
Okay.